TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of useful consciousness.
The way that the Earth's being attacked, we better just understand what the hell's going on and get out there and deal with it. And what it does to our minds and our perception of reality is doing the same thing to us. So before we're going to effectively really be able to deal with that, we need to understand what's happening to us. Well, you know what I mean about we're being mined. We're just more DNA of the Earth. We're just a different shape. We're just different uranium. We're different fossil fuel. Our spirits are being mined.
Mining in America. The voice of John Tudell, poet, musician, and Native American activist. We were standing below the Zortman-Landusky cyanide heap leach gold mine on the border of the Fort Belknap Reservation in Montana. I realized only later how prophetic Tudell's words were. What happens to the earth happens to us. We are being mined, even if most of us have never seen a mine. This program will take you to the land of the Western Shoshone, also known as Eastern Nevada. The 1863 Treaty of Ruby Valley, ratified by the U.S. Senate in 1866, outlines the boundaries of Shoshone territory from the Snake River in Idaho through Eastern Nevada into Death Valley, California. The treaty states clearly that this territory remains in Shoshone control. The only rights ceded were to some farming and small-scale mining by white settlers. The Shoshone also promised not to interfere with telegraph, mail, and train roads through their land. The Western Shoshone have their own government that receives some international diplomatic recognition. They use their own passports when traveling abroad. But here in the United States, attempts to break the Treaty of Ruby Valley continue to this day. At the signing of the treaty in 1863, the Indian agents of Nevada and the U.S. government were mostly concerned with the westward expansion. All they saw in Shoshone land was desert and barren mountains. Once the value of the land became apparent, they began breaking the treaty. The U.S. government seized part of Shoshone land to establish the Nevada Nuclear Weapons Test Site. Currently, they are in the process of building this country's only repository for high-level nuclear waste in Yucca Mountain on Shoshone land. And in the rest of Shoshone land, gold was found. Today, 84% of gold taken in Nevada comes from Shoshone territory. The value in dollars is staggering. Depending on the price of gold, it may be as much as $2.5 billion worth per year. The environmental destruction caused by modern mining for gold, silver, and copper is also staggering. The Environmental Protection Agency published the most recent data for toxic releases by the mining industry in May of 2000. It turns out that Nevada is by far the biggest polluter in the U.S. Among the toxins released by mining are mercury, arsenic, lead, and cyanide. In 1998, Nevada's mines released 1.3 billion pounds of these pollutants. In comparison, all chemical manufacturers nationwide combined released far less than half that amount. The Western Shoshone are not asking for a share of the billion-dollar profits in this modern-day gold rush on their land. Their leaders, among them the Dan Sisters, are concerned with the environmental devastation caused by mining, continuing nuclear testing, and waste dumping that is unparalleled in history. They do not even ask for personal title of the land and have steadfastly refused to accept money that was allocated by the U.S. government to buy the 24 million acres of Shoshone land inside Nevada. They want control to preserve Shoshone land for future generations, and they want to protect their beliefs and spirituality. I had first heard of the Dan Sisters in 1992. Friends of mine were collecting food and supplies to make the 500-mile journey from San Francisco to Crescent Valley. They went to protect the horse and cattle herds of the Dan Sisters from confiscation by the Bureau of Land Management. Earlier that year, the BLM had rounded up 161 wild horses as a media event. The BLM was determined to show the world that they would no longer tolerate the Dan sisters' herds on so-called public land. Mary and Carrie Dan refused to pay grazing fees. Why should they pay to run their herds on Shoshone land? On November 19, 1992, over 30 armed federal agents entered the Dan Ranch area in a paramilitary operation. They completely blocked the roads in and out. Dramatic video footage of the raid reached the outside. The Dan sisters, strong-armed by federal agents with no respect for their status as elders and grandmothers. Their brother Clifford trying to prevent the departure of the trucks filled with horses by threatening to set himself on fire, an act he later spent 9 months in prison for. For a moment, the world paid attention. A year later, Carrie and Mary Dan received the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize. Since that time, a small desert camp down the road from the Dan Ranch buildings and a trailer office in Crescent Valley have become the headquarters of the Western Shoshone Defense Project. Volunteers and white supporters have had a year-round presence to prevent any more taking of livestock, and the BLM has ceased confiscations. We joined the camp on the last leg of the TUC Radio Ecology Tour. While all elements of the defense project, CB radios, and the props for nonviolent resistance were still in place, the project had become a watchdog organization on gold mining and nuclear issues. While the Western Shoshone are being denied their rights to their land, any corporation, most of them foreign, can buy Shoshone land for $2.50 to $5 per acre under the 1872 mining law. The Canadian Barrick Gold Mine bought Shoshone land for a little over $5,000 and walked away with $10 billion worth of gold. In this arid desert land, the gold mines often drive their pits into the level of the aquifer. They are pumping out precious groundwater and are either dumping or evaporating it. It is not unusual for a single mine to pump 30,000 gallons per minute every day of the year. When we arrived at the Western Shoshone Base Camp, we were met by three volunteers. They told us that Mary and Carrie Dan were coming by almost daily with news and treats of food. We had just started on dinner preparation when a car pulled up. Mary and Carrie came with one of their grandchildren on their way back from Elko. A part on the baling wagon for hay had broken, and they needed to get a replacement. After dinner, Carrie, Dan, and I sat on a bench outside, overlooking the vast desert land that is now called Crescent Valley, and the ring of mountains that encircle it in the distance. I wondered what it had been like growing up here in a traditional Western Shoshone family.
Our childhood, my childhood was okay. I really didn't miss anything, you know. We had enough to eat. Mom made sure that she had a big garden. She had plenty of potatoes. She had plenty of, you know, other things. And in those days, you dried or you preserved one way or the other. And our medicines were mostly traditional medicines in which, you know, under which we, during those times, is which we depended on. And I don't think I ever went into town until, oh, gee, I must have been at least in the fifth or sixth grade in grade school. First trip I ever made into town that I can, you know, really remember. The rest of the time I lived out here. We had some sheep, which was one of our duties, you know. I eventually ended up having the sheep, and I used to herd the sheep. And all around through here, down on the flats and the mountains and everywhere else. Also, as a young kid, I had one horse. I had about three, maybe four dogs. And I used to go up in the mountains. I practically lived up there. You know, I used to leave maybe about 5 o'clock, sometimes maybe four. It all depends. I'd go tend to my sheep, open them, and then after all day long, I go around in the mountains
Like I told the BLM lady, I said, I probably know every water hole that is up there. Because as a kid, you know, I used to just walk all over, me and my dogs and my horse. But we were brought up very traditionally. And we learned how to respect all things from the time we were little. Hopefully that we're putting it into the minds of our grandchildren, you know, that you got to respect what's out there. And another thing that we also were told and we learned to respect is all kind of life, you know, plant life as well. Grandmother used to tell us, you know, always walk straight, don't lie and don't cheat, because she always said there's somebody that's always watching you. So you go up in the mountains, you do things, and then sometimes somebody says, well, what did you do that for? And you wonder, I wonder who was watching me. I wonder who saw what I did. They've always told you. Everything has ears. The plants have ears. They have eyes. They're witnesses. They're witness to the Creator and all this kind of stuff. And then you think, oh, my gosh, which one told on me? As a kid, you know, you wonder about all of these things. And we also learn, you know, in the mountains or anywhere, that the spirit lives. And everything has a spirit. Even plants have spirit. Everything has spirit, you know. Everything has life. Life is a spirit. In our ways, you know, the Creator himself can show himself through the different whatever he created. So, you know, we learn how to, you know, accept that too. We know that there's spirits that live in the mountains. We use the eagle spirit, and we use all kinds of spirits, and they all live up around the same place where we live. One thing our grandmother told us, that she said, you don't have to build a church to in order to worship, she said, because you are among his creation. And she said, that is your church. You can worship any place where you want. And now that, you know, I'm an older woman and I'm a grandmother, and I think about these things, that is really the only duty we have, and that is to pray for different things and ask for good things, and, you know, so that our life will continue to go on and the life of the other creation will continue to go on. And those are the things that we learned. We used to have, you know, four big ceremonies, which was the spring ceremony, the beginning of renewal of life. Then you had your summer ceremonies, your fall ceremonies, and your winter ceremonies. It's so beautiful, you know. It's all on nature. It's all on things. You can actually, when they start praying, it usually begins from the time that the snow melts, and up to the time first life is coming about. It's all based on how the natural things evolve around us up to the time again when the snow falls and everything is laying, you know, silent until up to the time the new life will begin again. We were very fortunate. We had a grandmother that talked about everything. She talked about everything that I can think of. And she also talked about, you know, the life that which we see today. She also talked about what we, our grandchildren, will see tomorrow. And it's not very pleasant what the grandchildren will see tomorrow. Everything has a value on it in the American dollar and cents. That's where everything is. If it's not worth anything in this modern society in which we live, it's worthless. There's, you know, if it has no dollar connections to it, it's worthless. And, you know, that isn't the way we were brought up. We were brought up to respect all things, and not because it, you know, is valued in dollars and cents. Right before my very eyes, things that's most sacred to us as Western Shoshone people or as indigenous people is being destroyed. All because they have one economic value, which is dollars and cents.
There's one incident where there was put a money value put on your land in 1957. You attended an Indian land claims meeting here.
Yeah, for the first time in my life, I went with my mother and my mom and dad, me and Mary, and we went to listen to this guy. His name was Robert W. Barker. He was supposed to represent the Indians in the Indian Claims Commission. some of the things that he said, I knew what is best for you, so I'm doing what is best for you people. And he also said that the government had taken our lands many, many, many years ago. And that I couldn't believe because, you know, in my family, it's always, it's Western Shoshone land. It has never been anything but Western Shoshone land. But that's the first time I've heard the word taking, T-A-K-I-N-G, taking of lands. And I learned in the American history, you know, that only dictators and tyrants can take lands. So it's not until later I find out different things about the Indian Claims Commission. Everything that they told to us was a lie. I mean, it was a total, outright lie. And they says, there's nothing you can do. He says, if you don't accept this, you won't get nothing. You know, that's a threat. A lawyer who's supposed to represent you is threatening you. It's in the form of intimidation.
So in some ways, this meeting, the Indian Claims Commission meeting, and meeting this guy, Robert Barker, that in some ways that really changed your life, didn't it?
It changed my whole thought. Not only that, we also had a court with our neighbor over one of the waters over here. One of our neighbors told us that, you know, our dad is fighting or, you know, over this water. The big man, meaning people that had much more money than what we had. And it was a good case. We lost it. They can imprison us for standing up for our rights. They can even kill us for standing up for our rights because you read so many stories about how, maybe not in the United States today, but certainly in the 1970s, during the time of Wounded Knee, there were people that also were found dead and for no reason at all, people that knew the country. Certainly they weren't going to freeze to death out there. They were somehow killed and thrown overboard. And all of these things happen here in the United States. We see it happening in South American countries where, you know, people in leadership, they just managed to die. It's not very long ago that United States or, you know, multinational companies, they're still giving money to governments to kill indigenous people wherever they may be located at simply because they won't part with their land. And they won't, you know, they won't allow the type of degradation that's going on. So to stand up against these multinational corporations, you got to be ready to give your life to what you believe in. This is our inherent rights. We were born Western Shoshones. We will be Western Shoshones up to the time that the earth will take us back. And, you know, that's the way I intend to go, is by being a Western Shoshone and trying to see that the future generations will have at least something to look forward to. At least have clean water. I don't know if this is going to happen because at the way that, you know, they're these multinational mining companies are destroying water, you know. I don't even know if there's going to be any water. I don't even know if those hills, are, you know, the west of us, will be there. I don't know that. There might be all man-made mountains by the time that, you know, in the next 20 to 30 years, maybe a little beyond that. But, you know, can you imagine? Can you imagine men, human, actually destroying land, destroying water, the givers of life, to get to that gold? I can't imagine what importance gold is. I may have few things in that's, you know, gold plated, but I don't own anything that's gold. I never did in my life, and I don't intend to now. And I keep telling our own people, you know, today, I says, well, whose mountain are you wearing? Whose water did you destroy to wear what you got on? I try to bring that consciousness to them as to the destruction of what gold is doing. And I think that everybody should realize that when they wear gold jewelry, they're destroying the future generations' right to life, because in most of the mining companies that is close around here, they pump water. And when you are pumping water, you're destroying the future generations' rights. And any time you wear that gold, that's what you're doing.
Now, there are two things I really admire you for. One is when the Supreme Court came up with this decision, they offered you sort of your personal deal. They said you could claim your personal title.
Oh, individual rights, they called it. No, we couldn't do that. It's not our way. If we did, we'd become Europeanized or Europeanized. We can never own the land because this land does not belong to us personally. It belongs to life, and we couldn't do that. It belongs to all Shoshones. It belongs to anybody that lives. It belongs to the bugs. We can't do that.
And the other thing is the Indian Claims Commission put $26 million into an account, and you are one of the people who very, very strongly refused not to take it, but others haven't taken it either.
We didn't control our own destiny in that. It was all controlled at D.C. by the people in, I guess, Secretary of Interior's office, or Secretary of Interior himself. He's the one that accepted that $26 million. Western Shoshones didn't accept that $26 million. That was accepted by United States, from United States, selling to United States our land without our approval. Now, if you don't call that a dictatorship, what the hell do you call it?
Carrie Dan, sister of Mary Dan, traditional elder of the Western Shoshone. She spoke to me outside the base camp of the Western Shoshone Defense Project in Crescent Valley, in what is now called Nevada. Her grandson was getting bored, and he was the one drumming in the background. I felt that I should stop asking questions, so they could drive him home to the Dan Ranch. The issue of the ownership of the eastern half of Nevada by the Western Shoshone remains unresolved to this day. The Dan sisters have taken the case all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court turned the Shoshone down because they had supposedly been awarded money in compensation for the taking of their land. At the May 2000 spring gathering on the Nevada test site, I met the coordinator of the Western Shoshone Defense Project, Chris Sewell. He told me that the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights had just recently, after 7 years of consideration, admitted the case of the Western Shoshone. Here is Chris Sewell.
Working with the Indian Law Resource Center in Helena, Montana, a case was presented by Mary and Carrie Dan before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And this commission was set up by the Organization of American States to monitor and promote human rights within all the member states of the OAS, of course, which the U.S. is part of. So since 1993, both the Indian Law Resource Center and the Western Shoshone have been submitting information in support of the Western Shoshone issues, and the U.S. has been countering that information, sending responses to the commission. Fortunately, in late September of last year, the Inter-American Commission made a positive determination on the admissibility of the case. And the U.S., of course, has been arguing that this isn't a human rights issue at all, that the Western Shoshone have had their due process in the U.S. courts, and that, in fact, they've been awarded money for their lands, which the people have, of course, rejected since 1979, 1980, when the U.S. tried to award that money.
Can you remind us how much money that is and how brave these people are who are so poor of not touching it?
Well, in 1979, the Indian Claims Commission awarded $26 million for over 24 million acres of Western Shoshone land. That has been sitting in a trust account. The Secretary of Interior of the U.S. accepted that money on behalf of the Western Shoshone as their trustee, despite the fact that the people didn't want the money and had never intended to sell their land. And that is what the U.S. has said. Well, the money has been accepted. So the government took the money out of one pocket and put it into another, and then claimed that the people had due process and they have been compensated for their land. So today, the money is in a trust account, and they say there's $114 or $115 million in that trust account right now. And it's being used as another divide-and-conquer tactic by the U.S. government against the people, because there are some Shoshone people who feel that this is all they're ever going to get from the U.S. government, so they really just ought to take the money. And, of course, there are other Shoshone people that understand that this is essentially blood money, that the land can never be sold, and that this is the U.S.'s way of trying to disregard the treaty and the obligations that they have to the Western Shoshone people. It's really bad right now. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is working with a certain faction of Western Shoshone people to try to get a bill in Congress to distribute this trust fund. It'd be a one-time payment. Everybody would receive one individual check. And what we're trying to tell people, you know, is that the land, first of all, was never for sale. You can't sell the land under a traditional Western Shoshone perspective, that you don't sell your mother. But also the fact is, what makes this generation of Western Shoshone more important than the ones that came before and the ones that will come after? Because that's what you're saying. If this money gets distributed now among all the people that are living right now, there's nothing for the future generations. It's just this one-time payment. And we're trying to get that across to people, but the federal government is really working hard to, in ignoring the wishes of even its own federally recognized tribal councils who have come out against this bill, against the distribution as it now stands, because they all have land issues. So they're ignoring their own federally recognized tribal councils to work with a faction who weren't elected by the people. They represent some Shoshone, but they're not official. They're not a traditional government. They're not a federally recognized government. But the Bureau of Indian Affairs is actively collaborating with these people to write a bill to submit to Congress to distribute, to liquidate this trust fund, which, you know, we feel is in direct contradiction to their, you know, self-proclaimed trust responsibility. The government has said that they have a trust responsibility to look after the best interests of Indian people. But as far as we can tell right now, they're actively, you know, working against the best interests of the people in the future generations.
That was Chris Sewell, coordinator of the Western Shoshone Defense Project, recorded on a windy day inside one of the large tents of the peace camp at the Nevada test site in May of 2000. This was the first half of a one-hour program on the Western Shoshone and their fight to protect their ancestral land from gold mining and nuclear testing and dumping. Next week, we're visiting with the Timbisha Shoshone in Death Valley. You can reach the Western Shoshone Defense Project by email at wsdp@igc.org, or you can phone at 775-468-0230. The Western Shoshone Defense Project needs your support. Call 775-468-0230 or email at wsdp@igc.org. If you can't remember the information, go to TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. For a copy of this program, call toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. The music is by G.S. Sarstev. My name is Mariah Gallardin. Thank you for listening.